Okay, so it's Perek Zayin and Tanya. Lisa, you
yes.
Okay, good. Okay, so he ended off Perek Vav. He started talking about the two kinds of klippas. So we, because in the beginning of chapter 6, discussed the nefesh abamis, the animal soul has 10 powers, 3 garments, just like the godly soul does. But in the animal soul comes from the world of klippa, which is the world of not the side of holiness, the world that conceals and blocks Hashem's presence, so to speak. But then he said at the end that there's two kinds of klippas. So klippa, there's the what we call from Yecheskel. It's all drawn from a pasuk in Yecheskel, from psukim in Yecheskel, when he had the celestial vision and he saw different things. And they said he saw like a very thick cloud. And it gives 3 expressions. And kabbalistically, that refers to the 3 complete klippas. So that's things like Avodah Zarah, anything to do with Avera, anything else that's negative in the world, anything that we can't refine or elevate, any issur, anything that's prohibited, any experience that's prohibited, all these things come from the world of complete klippa. We call klippas hatmeyas legamri. They are completely unclean, and it's normally in the context of shalosh klippas hatmeyas, the 3 complete impure klippas. Okay, that's those 3. However, now it comes to the nefesh habamis of a Jew and the neutral things and so on and so forth. This is like this. Perek Zayin. Ach nefesh hachiyunis habamis, but the life that gives the soul, which is the soul that provides life, habamis, the animal soul, should be shol with a Jew, shemitzara klippa, which also comes from klippa, as we've explained. Hamalubeshes b'dam ha'odom, which is in the blood of the person, it expressed itself in the blood of the person, canal, as we said before, to give it life. And also the kiyu, the nafshois, behemois, v'chayois, and also the soul of the animals, the wild animals, the oifois, the birds, the dogim, and the fish, tohoirim, which are pure, meaning umutorim ba'achila, they're kosher. Right? And in that category, which we're about to explain in another kind of klippa, v'chein kiyum, v'chayos, kol ha'maise, dibur, umachshove, the life force of any action, speech, or thought, with regard to this world, that has no prohibition to it, completely kosher. It doesn't have any origin, it doesn't have any branch, it doesn't have anything to do with the negative commandments and their derivatives, whether they're biblical or rabbinic. The only thing is, they're just not for the sake of heaven. They're completely neutral. A person is doing something that's kosher, but not for any lofty purpose, not for any service of God. Elo, what is it? Rotzoin haguf v'cheftza. It's just the desire of the body and the will of the body, v'tavasa, and his lust, his desire. And he says something very, very powerful. He says, v'afilu hutzoyre haguf v'kiyumoy v'chayusei mamash. Even if it's for the purpose of health. Right? Which is interesting, right? Because it gives a little bit of light to what we explained before. Klippa is klippa. Klippa means something that hides Hashem, right? Not the side of Kedusha, unholy. But it doesn't always mean evil, like the way we interpret evil, right? So when a person, for example, doesn't indulge in eating and just eats in a healthy diet and a healthy way, that's pretty good, actually, right? But it's still klippa, because it's not God. It could be a completely ungodly person and still do that, right? It's nice, it's got some potential good to it, it's disciplined and all that, but it's unholy, it's not God, right? As he says, even if it's for the purpose of existence, sustenance, and life, in other words, health, it's important to eat that way. The only thing is, Elisha kavan nosa ein l'sham shemayim. It's just that his intention is not for the sake of heaven. Kedei la avodas Hashem begufay. He's not eating. His sole purpose of eating is not to serve Hashem better. Right? That's not the purpose. Just to be to exist. So he's saying it's still part of klippa because klippa means that's why we call it 2 words: klippa and sitra achra. Sitra achra means it's the other side of kedusha. If it's not holiness, then it's unholy. Right. And then, therefore, because it's unholy, it's also klippa. Klippa means it's a skin. It's hiding the presence of God. Yeah. So all of these experiences, even though they're kosher, and even though they're neutral, even though they might be even good things, kind of thing, lo adifi maisa dibur umachshova Elu, these actions, speech, and thoughts are not any better from the animal soul itself. So the animal soul is klipa, so are these actions klipa, right? And what is this klipa that we're talking about? He says, v'hakoil ka'asher l'akoil. All of this, nishpa v'nimshach, is influenced and comes down v'madrega ha'sheni shiba klipa, from the second level of klipa, v'sitra achra, or sitra achra, she klipa revis, it's the fourth klipa. The first time we said three klipas, completely impure ones. I'm not sure if it's ever explained why it's three, but anyway, whatever it is, it's three klipas which are completely impure. This is the fourth one. What is it called? Hanikras klipas noiga. It's called klipas noiga. Klipas noiga, the word noiga, by the way, also comes from a pasuk in Yecheskel, where he says there, v'noiga lo soviv, there was some light around. It comes to the word light, right? Shining. It means, klipa normally is associated with the concept of darkness. What does it mean, darkness? It means it completely conceals Hashem's presence, and therefore it's dark, spiritually dark, right? The Metzudas Dovi, one of the commentaries on Tanakh, when the word Noga comes up in Yecheskel, he says, the word Noga means like zricha, like to shine, like the sun shines, right? Meaning this klipa has some rays of shining in it, some rays of light in it, which, it's still klipa, the experience is still klipa, it's not a godly experience, but there's some rays of light which are potentially godly, right? What that means, actually, therefore, that the klipas noiga is, because we have to explain how this works, how this is broken down. Klipas noiga is always klipa, but it's like a mixture of good and bad. Meaning there are parts of it that are just remain klipa and always remain klipa, but there are parts of it that can be elevated and redeemed and transformed to kedusha. Follow? Okay, now, so he says these are called klipas noiga. Shaba olam hazeh, which is in this world. Now, this world, he says, is rubay kekulay ra. This world generally is a place of mostly bad. Rak me'at toiv me'ura m'soicho. Just a little bit of good is mixed in. What is he referring to? Let me just explain. So, sorry? No, that's not always. It's this is the world where we make a dwelling place for Hashem. But it all depends what aspect you're looking at. But it's important to understand the problem before you can transform the problem or redeem the problem or bring light to the problem. Now, so what this means is as follows, all right? So we've made reference, I'll just explain it, the way it's explained in the Mefarshim. So we've often made reference to Seder Ishtalshlus, right? The order of worlds. We talked about Olam Atzilis, the world of Atzilis, which is God's world. That's a world which is full of Kedusha. It's a world, in other words, it's got 10 limited, finite powers, but nevertheless, that's by choice. That's what Hashem wanted. That's where Hashem expressed himself, and therefore it's a world which even though it's got 10 defined powers, but it's a world filled with manifestation of godliness. It's God expressing himself through those finite powers, and it's fully godly, right? And God is one with that world. That's what we said. Hashem and His wisdom are one. Hashem and His guru are one. His chesed are one, and so on. Where do we find existence starting to take place? In the world of Bria, right? So we've got three spiritual worlds, which are the beginning of creation. Creation meaning something which appears to be independent of godliness, right? Which is the worlds of Bria, Yitzira, Asiya. Okay. Now, the way it says in Kabbalah and in Chassidus, is that the world of Bria is mostly good, a little bit of bad. What does that mean? It means the world of Bria is also, it's a world, it's an existence. Most of it is, for the most part, it's still a very godly existence. It's a world that understands its complete dependence on God. God is fully revealed there, it's fully, right? However, it's a little bit of bad because it exists. In other words, there's an aspect of it which is not completely surrendered to God. There's a part of it which is independent, and therefore that's the bad part of it, right? When you go to the world of Yetzirah, it says it's half-half. It's already more of an existence, a good existence, a whole existence, but an existence nonetheless. It's Tani said, okay? And therefore it's considered half-half. When it comes to Asiya, the third world, it says Rubai Ra, it's mostly bad and only a little bit good. Meaning, for the most part, it's not bottle, it's not surrendered to Hashem. There's aspects of feelings of godliness there and holiness and revelation of godliness, and so on and so forth, right? Those are the three worlds. However, our world is not part of the three worlds. Our world is, because when I talk about the three worlds, are the three spiritual worlds, including the world of Asiya, of which we are creations of. So our world is called the Asiya Hagashmis. So when we talk about Seder Ishtals, we talk about the four worlds. The fourth world is called Asiya of Ruchnis. It's a spiritual Asiya. Whereas our world is Asiya Gashmis, it's the physical Asiya. And in our world is, it says more than just mostly bad, it's Rubai Kakulai Ra. It's almost all bad. What does that mean? What does it mean bad? What does it mean bad? It doesn't mean it's an evil world. It's not supposed to be a depressing statement. It's just supposed to be a reality definition, that's all. What does that mean? It means that, for the most part, this world is not a world where you feel God. It's a world that completely hides and camouflages and conceals godliness. Right? No one can say, most people can't say, just by default, that they feel godliness, right? Yeah, when the Yidden stood at Har Sinai, they felt godliness. They saw godliness. Tzaddikim rise a bit above the world and they feel godliness, right? And Hashem obviously feels godly, but for the most part, Hashem is not part of our revealed consciousness, right? That's more hidden than us, right? So we are the Nefesh HaBamis. Nefesh HaBamis doesn't feel God. In this world, generally, God is not felt. That's why this world is mostly Klippah. However, it's mostly not the Klippah Hatzmeus Legamri. It's not the... For the most part, the world is not the complete Klippah. It's the Klippas Noiga, meaning it's still a place of Klippah, still a place that conceals godliness and blocks godliness sometimes, but it has potential, it has rays of light which can be revealed, which can be elevated and redeemed and so on.
So,
Rabbi,
it's the fourth world.
Well, it's not normally listed as a fourth world. It's listed as a subset of Asiya. Yeah, right. It's like the subset of Asiya.
But
Asiya is... There's a spiritual Asiya, and then there's we are the physical Asiya.
Okay, and where's that's under the three spiritual?
Yeah. So we rock bottom, basically.
Like there's cream at the top, and then...
And then us, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But outside of those three spiritual worlds.
Correct. Because the purpose of creation, as we learn in Chassidus, is that Hashem wanted a dwelling place... In a lower form of existence. But what Exodus always puts it is, he wanted it in a place, which means it's a low existence and there's nothing lower. What does it mean nothing lower? It means it's a place of complete concealment. Not only complete concealment, but it's a world that opposes godliness very often. It stands in the way of godliness, it fights godliness. It's a world that doesn't have any feeling by default, unless we learn about it and believe in it. There's no feeling in this world, even by people, that I didn't make myself. In other words, that I'm not just a random thing, that I actually am dependent, my whole life force depends on a higher being, depends on God. That's not the feeling in this world. That's not the consciousness in this world. It is in some of the upper worlds, and even in Asiya, there's a bit of that, in the spiritual Asiya. But not in this world. This world is a world where God is completely hidden. But his hiddenness is in the context often of klipas noiga. Not complete klipa, but klipas noiga. There's complete klipa too, but there's a lot of it is klipas noiga. So we talked about the non-Jewish soul last time. I don't want to go there again. But
we brushed over that very quickly. And you just raised over those.
But no, because as we explained, even that is normal. It's not an unnormal.
But so the fish and kosher animals and our souls come from the same klippa.
Yeah, our animal souls.
Our animal souls.
Yeah, the non-Jewish soul also depends who the non-Jew is. Remember, we said that Chassidu Umasaylam, the righteous of the world, do have a klippas noiga. What does that mean? You see, again, as I said last time, just because a non-Jewish soul is klippas atzmeis legamri, it doesn't mean it's evil. It just means that it's locked into a concealment of godliness. That's its existence. It can do good things. And it can create, very positively contribute to the functionality of the world.
And the other inanimate things in the world, I mean, it's crazy to say inanimate because they're all got a godly life force in them. But
yeah, so you know what everyone said about that? When they first, this is just a side point, a beautiful idea, when they first printed, they first translated the Tanya into English, so the concept of inanimate or doimem comes up a lot. and I don't know who it was, whether it was a Mangel or a Bashachat, he wrote into the Rebbe and he translated it as inanimate. And the Rebbe sent back that that's not accurate, but the Rebbe preferred the translation as silent rather than inanimate. The word doim is silent, which means, because it's a good point, it actually ties into this. Because why is it silent? What does it mean silent? It means like this. So this world is a place that hides godliness, right? However, there are, in the hiddenness, in the concealment of godliness itself, there are different levels. For example, if you see an animal, if you see a plant, right? You don't see godliness, but you see life, right? So it's easier to make the connection there to God, at least intellectually. A stone, you don't see anything. There's no life. But it's not true. There is a soul. Just like there's a soul in the plant keeping it alive, a godly soul. Not a godly soul, I mean a spark of God, right? So too, there's a godly spark in the stone. However, it's silent. So therefore, it's even more concealing of godliness in a way.
And does that come from
Noga?
No, also
Noga. If it's not forbidden, right? And has a potential godly use, then it's, I mean, the Beis HaMikdash was built out of stone, right? In 3 weeks now, the Beis HaMikdash was built out of stone. Those are stones that were taken and elevated to Kedusha. But the reason that it was built of stone, different to the Mishkan wasn't built of stone, is because the Beis HaMikdash fulfilled the purpose of the Mishkan more than the Mishkan did. Because the Beis HaMikdash brought, transformed or elevated a lower form of existence, stone. As opposed to wood, which is comes from tzomeach, comes from the vegetation, things that grow, mm-hmm. Right? So, how do we get into this? Yeah. So we are part of the world of asiyah. Not only asiyah, but asiyah gashmis, the physical asiyah, which means we're rubay kakulay ra, we're almost completely bad. Not even like asiyah, which is mostly bad. We are almost all bad. Meaning this world is a place of klipah, and many times it says in Exodus now. Again, I think just a sidebar, but nevertheless, that's important to understand, because it's not meant to put the world in a negative space. You know that the Rebbe has this famous talk where he talks about the mimer of the previous Rebbe based on the pasuk of Bosi Legani, when I came to my garden, when Hashem says, when I came to Matan Torah, I came to my garden, right? And this world is called Hashem's garden. The Rebbe says some people look at the world and they see a jungle. But you can also look at the world and see a garden. What does that mean? It means like this. Both things are true. In other words, there's the potential of the world and that the world, what the world is. At the default setting of the world is a jungle, a place of complete concealment. It's a place of complete darkness. Why is that important to know? Because it's important to know what our job is. In other words, before you can bring Hashem into the world, you need to know that the world is a place of concealment. And that's, therefore, your approach to the world will be different, right? One of the big things of Chassidus is negating worldliness, right? Previously, Rebbe talks about Allah, and the Rebbe, and Tanya, and all, right? To negate worldliness. So what are we doing here then? It's not because the world is bad. The world, as in its current state, is klipas noiga, most of it, right? And therefore, or klipas hatmeis lagamri. And therefore, but we know this is an amazing world. This is a world where Hashem wants to live. But in order to make Hashem live here, you have to make the world be a godly place. How do you make the world be a godly place? By not getting caught up in worldliness. What they call in Yiddish, Weltischkeit. How do you not get caught up? Is to first know the problem of the world. The problem of the world is that it's all klipah. So if you just use the world or engage in the world for the world's sake, you're just engaging in klipah. Right? Like he says, for example, he says, therefore, even eating, like, if you're not eating for the sake of Hashem, then it's just world. Then you're being part of the klipah. You're not being part of the redemption of the world. You're being part of the klipah of the world, right? I know there's a hard concept. I mean, again, I say this every year, but we're learning things how they are in its purity, and then we take one step towards that, right? But that's a big emphasis in... It's a big emphasis in Tanya, a big emphasis in Chassidus about not pursuing materialism, not pursuing world, even when it's mutter, even when it's permissible.
So is God inhabiting this world that we're in now?
Well, God is inhabiting, but he's hidden. We are making him revealed. So you do a mitzvah. So for example, so let's just break this down once we ask that question. So there are certain things that we do in this world where we make it complete kedushas. So when you take a piece of leather and you do a mitzvah with it, you turn it into a klaf upon which a mezuzah is written, that whole thing becomes godly. Now that doesn't mean that me and you can see it, but it's changed. In other words, before we wrote the mezuzah on it, its essence was something that hides godliness. It wasn't godly. In other words, it was really a part of the tzimtzum process, a part of the concealment process. When you make a mezuzah, it is transformed. Maybe not for me and you, because maybe we don't have the eyes to see it. But those who do have the eyes to see it, like great tzaddikim, for example, can sense a complete transformation in the piece of parchment when it was part of the animal, when it becomes part of the mezuzah. When Mashiach comes, we'll all see it. We'll all see how the mezuzah was elevated to an unbelievable level, right? So that's the Yom Kedusha. But even things which are not Kedusha, even things which are purely mundane, if we use them l'shem shemayim, as he's about to explain, if we use them for the sake of heaven, but only for the sake of heaven, then we elevate them. The elevation process there is a bit different to a mitzvah, because you don't elevate all of it. That's why we call this concept of birur. We elevate the parts of it which is more Kedusha, and then the parts of it which is klipa gets expelled, right? Which is the spiritual digestive system in terms of food, right? In other words, we elevate the part, we elevate, the rest gets expelled from the body, right? But it's only elevated to Kedusha if we use it properly. And it's a very difficult thing. In other words, before we use it properly, it's actually part of klipa, right? Because you're going to talk about this idea of eating, for example, right? That's why it's such a tricky process. I think I told you this before. That's why, you know, in the tradition of Hasidim, and older Hasidim particularly, there was this thing where they were always very scared about getting involved in Gashmis. Even though we have to get involved in Gashmis, because that's how you bring Hashem into the world, right? So it's a tricky process, this. We're supposed to use the world, but yet the world is a dangerous place. Because when you get engaged with Gashmis, you need to know that it's dangerous. That's why it brings us, right? You need to know that at its current status, it's complete klipa. Or klipas noiga, which is still klipa, right? And therefore you need to know that engaging with it is very dangerous. I saw a story with the Rebbe Rashab that he was once at a gathering with his father, Rebbe Marash. And Rebbe Marash hadn't come in, and all Chassidim were there. He was there, he was like a 10-year-old boy. And he suddenly got very, very thirsty, and like the other side of the room there was some water. So he wiggled his way in, pushed his way through the crowd, and he poured himself a half a cup of water and drank it. Then he went back to his place. And then like it was still a long time until Rebbe Marash was coming in, and then like half an hour later he was still thirsty. So he went back and he drank another half a cup. So one of the older Chassidim said to him, "Why did you just drink the full cup to begin with? If you were thirsty, just drink it up." He says, "I was trained by my father, or trained by Chassidim." He says, "When you want something, you don't do the whole thing right away. You always hold back a little bit." He said, right? In other words, there was a big thing. In fact, so much so, I don't know if I told you this before, but so much so that there was a well-known thing by Chassidim that, you know, who were very immersed in Tanya and trying to aspire what Tanya wants from us, especially on a higher level, that there was this thing, you know, Chassidim were always very, what we call mahadda, they were always very strict in mitzvahs. So, you know, part of Chassidus is because godliness is so front and center of our world. So, for example, a person has to buy a mezuzah, so you buy a nice mezuzah. You have to buy a tefillin, you buy a nice tefillin. Right? If Shulchan Aruch gives two opinions, it says, you know, it's better to do the stricter opinion, so you do the stricter opinion, right? All that kind of stuff. So you do a mitzvah beautifully. You have to eat matzah and pesach, you eat a lot of matzah, whatever, you make sure it's a big, it's a kazayis according to all opinions, that kind of thing. But there was a well-known thing by Chassidim that mitzvahs that the body also has pleasure from, we're not so strict. We do it, but we're not so strict. Why? Because it's very, very tricky. Mm-hmm. Right? And even when it's a mitzvah, the classic example was Shabbos, right? Even though we learn Sfarim, there's this kind of food and that kind of food, and people make these kind of herrings and that kind of fishes, you know, for Shabbos, and everything's got meaning and purpose. All the real Hasidim would live this way would not be so into the food. Wouldn't talk about it. Wouldn't. Yeah, they'd wash on Shabbos and eat with a fish, whatever. But more than a weekday, maybe, but not. They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't be strict about it because.
On the ice cream.
No, well, yeah, well, that's for sure. But even the they weren't so frum when it came to those mitzvahs. Obviously, they did the mitzvah because you have to do it. Why? Because they were scared of it. Because any mitzvah that the goof also has pleasure that can pull you in two directions. Right? Okay, so that's the point. So now I'm trying to bring out, that's why, on the one hand, we're supposed to be in the world. That's the whole point of Yiddishkeit, to bring Hashem into the world. But the more we go into the world, especially nowadays, where we're more into the world than in previous generations, the more we have to understand the challenge and more we have to understand the danger and try and work with that danger. So it's not about, this is not intended about looking down at the world as, you know, I wish I was a malach. But it is, in a way, because it's working down the world in its current state. So to know what you're working with in order to know where you have to bring the world to.
Has the world been in a better current state, this bottom world?
Has it been?
In a better current state. Like, has it been, has it always been as bad as it is? Or was it?
So it's interesting you say that. So on the one hand, we actually believe that, so on the one hand, today's world is in a very, the darkness before dawn is always darker. Right. However, another analogy you can give to the world like this, because on the other hand, there's an accumulative effect of all the mitzvahs and all the service Hashem has been done throughout the generations, right? Mm-hmm. I think the best mashal to understand it is that nowadays the world is like this. Actually, it's actually in a better state. It's been elevated throughout all generations. But it's like a beautiful, beautiful designed, handcrafted plate that is now covered with a lot of schmutz. So the schmutz is very real, but it's just a cover. And we're just finishing that to take it off. But the schmutz is schmutz. Right? Okay. As he says, that's why he says that this world, which is called the world of Asiya, Rubay Kakulay Ra, most of it is bad. Rak ma'at toiv mu'udra b'soicha, only a little bit is mixed in. Only a little bit of good is mixed in. Which, by the way, he says, Shemimeno bois midus toivish ben nefesh abam mishibi yisrael k'moshe yisbarlel. The little bit of good that is naturally in the world also brings some good, like we said at the very beginning of Tanya, that even from the Nefesh HaBamis, a person has some good middos. There's a good character traits, which are not super godly, but they're good. They're good middos because there has some good in it. Right? So it doesn't breed only bad. Now he says like this, this klipas noiga, b'chine memutzas, is like a middle intermediary, bein sholosh klipas atmeis legamri, between the three clippers which are completely tame, it's very simple. You have to stay away from them. Treif animal, you've got to stay away from it. It's very simple. For prohibited experience, you've got to stay away from it. Not always easy, but that's the pathway, the goal is very clear. Just stay away from it. Don't engage with it at all. Right? Because it makes you part of the clipper, it makes you distant from Hashem, and that's it. The clippers noiga is much more tricky, which is most of our day, by the way. Realize that, right? There's certain parts of our life which are complete tummy. Those are the things we're not allowed to do. So we know what we have to do with them. We have to learn the Shulchan Aruch and just keep it, right? It's I was going to say it's simple. It's not simple, but it's clear. Then there's parts of our life which are Kedusha, where we do things that are complete godliness. A mitzvah, lulav, davening, learning, those are just complete Kedusha things. Okay, there's a struggle there too, because we do them on different levels. We have to make sure our ego isn't moved into it, and so on and so forth. But what we're doing is holy. Most of our life, we spend engaging in klipas noiga, which is much more tricky. And he says it's an intermediary between klipas atmeis legamri and between kedusha. So what happens to it? It says like this: v'lochein, it doesn't stay when you engage with it. It doesn't stay neutral. This is the concept, right? Pa'omim, sometimes she nichleles b'shalosh klipat atmeis. Sometimes what ends up happening is it gets downgraded when you engage with it for the wrong reason, for an ungodly reason. Then it actually becomes part of real klipas atmeis. It can be redeemed later, as we explain later in Tanya. It's not like something treif that has no redemption. It actually does. But you send it down, you downgrade it at least temporarily. Like it's written, okay. Right. However, upa'omim, she nichleles ve'oile, sometimes you upgrade it. You upgrade it and it elevates to the level of Kedusha. Now, what does that mean? He says, not the whole thing necessarily. This is the part we have to understand properly. The Hainu, what it means is like this. The good which is in it, right? Nisbarer is sifted out, mehara. V'goyver v'oyle v'nichlal pagdusha. So listen to what he says. He says two things here. When you use klipas noiga correctly, you are, the good is becoming selected from the bad. So the first step of the process is you divide the bad and the good. V'goyver v'oyle, and then it's empowered. Right? V'oyle, and it elevates and it becomes part of kedusha. So what does that mean? It means like this. The mixture of good and bad in any klipas noiga means that it's all unclear, right? So you have an activity, whatever it is. Let's say eating, right? Okay, let's say eating fish, eating cake, whatever, right? So it's can be done for the wrong reason, the bad reason, so the good reason. So it's all mixed up at the moment. Right now, it's just a piece of cake. I'm giving a simple example, right? I don't know if I told you this. Maybe that's why I gave the mashal of a cake. When I was in Yechidus with the Rebbe, when I had the private rooms with the Rebbe when I was 13, the Rebbe asked me, am I learning Chassidus from time to time? Which I wasn't at the time, and the Rebbe said I should start. So my father arranged for me to learn with a rabbi there called Rabbi Groner. His son lives in Sydney, actually, one who's in KA. So he became my mashpia, my mentor for many years. Until I went away, I used to learn with him once a week, twice a week. So whenever I didn't understand something, he always give me a mashal. He always used to say, imagine a piece of chocolate cake. He was an American, so he had an American accent. So I always remember the chocolate cake. It was always the mashal. It was always the example of what he wanted to explain. Like I once asked, what's the difference between iskafi and ishapcha? Right? There's a thing he said, iskafi, like subjugating yourself and transformation. So he said, exactly. For example of a chocolate cake. Iskafi means you want the chocolate cake, but you're not going to eat it. Ishapcha means when you transform, it means you don't even want it. So, but it was always a mashal of the, yeah.
Well, we understand the kind of
that's right. It's a good mashal. It's a relatable mashal. Okay. So, a piece of chocolate cake, right? So, right now, it's just a piece of chocolate cake. So, the first thing you need to do is you have to, there's comes something called biru. There's a bad part of it and a good part of it. The good part of it is the purpose, the potential purpose that's in it, right? Not so much purpose in chocolate cake, but a little bit of chocolate on Shabbos, whatever the purpose is. Oh, I'm really doing it to serve Hashem. So I'm sifting out the purpose from the rest of it, right? The rest of it is just klipa, it's a piece of food, it brings enjoyment. The physical pleasure in it, that's really part of klipa. Unless that pleasure is for Hashem's sake, right? Okay. Then he says that you sift out the good from the bad, and then the good is elevated to Kedusha. Because even when the good is selected, before you elevate it, it's still klipa. So I'll give you an example. We learned in Perek Aleph, right? Things that are completely Kedusha means they're completely godly. There's no sense of independent existence. So for example, we learned in Perek Aleph that even from the Nefesh HaBamis, which is Klipas Noiga, the Nefesh HaBamis naturally brings some bad midas and it brings some good midas. So that's why a person naturally is kind, right? Okay. So that kind is a good thing. He wants to help other people, right? But before before we mix in the Nefesh HaLakis to it, it's still Klipa. Because it's still me. I'm kind. It's still me. It's not, I'm doing it and it's a mitzvah and I know all that, but there's still a sense of independence there. Therefore, it's not complete Kedusha. Kedusha means it's completely subservient to God. Right? That's why he's sifting out here. He said that when you refine the good from the Nefesh, from the Klipas Noiga, first of all, you sift out what's good apart from what's bad. That's a sifting process. Boireir. Right? And then the good, you attach yourself to the good. And if you do it for the right reason, then you elevate the good to actual Kedusha. Becomes a mitzvah, becomes Kedusha. Right? That's how it works. Are we clear? Now, he gives an example. Kegoy, Derech Losh, for example. If you want to follow, it's on page 22. The middle of the page. Kegoy, Dalet Mem, it says it's like an abbreviation. Dalet Mem. Kegoy, Derech Losh. Oichel bisra shmeino de tura. He's saying this example because it comes from Gemara. So it's not a chocolate cake example. Oichel bisra de tura shmeino de tura. Someone eats fat meat from an ox. Or v'shoyse yayin mevusam, where he drinks, mevusam means spiced up wine. I don't know what that means. Spiced wine? What's spiced wine? Whatever. Good wine. And what does he do it? Which probably we can't, none of us can really probably say this, but he does it laharchiv daitoy, to broaden his mind, l'ashem u'l'teirasa, to connect Hashem and his Torah. Now, why did he bring this mashal? He says, "Kad Omar Rava," this comes from a Gemara, there was a great tzaddik called Rava. Rava was asked a question one night, and he didn't answer the question. Right? So Rava the next day said, he answered him the question. He says, "Why didn't you answer me the question last night?" He said, "Because I didn't tell you the question last night because I hadn't had my portion of good meat." Because apparently Rava, for whatever reason, was able to think better when he ate a good shtickel flesh and he drank some wine. Because he said, "Chamra v'recha," he said, wine and like spices, smelling spices, broadens the mind. And therefore, when I do that, the next morning I had that breakfast or that lunch, whatever, and now I'm able to explain to you this idea, right? So a person that does that, then he's sifting out the good from the bad of the meat, and he's elevating it to a kedusha. Now, that's a perfect example, as the Mefarshim explained, right? That the something you talk about, something, I mean, nowadays we have maybe even more solid examples of indulgence, but in those days, meat and wine was like, that was it, right? That was the ultimate taiva. So it's a dangerous process. Because if you only eat it for, the more indulgent you are, the more you physically enjoy it, the more it can drag you down spiritually more than upgrade you, right? So Rava was a person who didn't have that desire to eat it for a bad reason, and he ate it only in order to learn better. When you do that, you're actually elevating it. And you're probably elevating it to a very high level, because the more something can draw you down, the higher it can be elevated. That's the double-edged sword, you understand? Oy, for example, if a person eats it, b'shvil k'day l'kayim mitzvahs oynek Shabbos v'yontif. He does it mamish to fulfill the mitzvah of having pleasure on Shabbos v'yontif, right? That's what I say, but the problem is that it's not so easy then. That's why Chassidim weren't so frum about this halacha. Why? Because, the famous story I've told you many times about the Baal Shem Tov. So he said he saw an ox with a shtreimel eating cholent. He said it was a covered Shabbos. It wasn't a covered Shabbos. It was because he likes cholent. Right? So that's okay.
So, Levi, when you've elevated something, does it stay elevated? Does it go into the bank of elevation?
Yeah, if you've used that power for
Kedusha. So, if there's a certain amount of Tipas and Moriba, and mostly bad, a little bit of good, and the 5,000 years of being elevated, many pieces of that, is that where we're going to?
Yeah.
Once it's up.
It really, what it's called in Kabbalah, it's called Avoidas Habirurim. It says that Hashem created the world. I'm not going to go into that, it's a very difficult thing to explain, but this idea of Shviras Hakelim, there was the breaking of the vessels, and sparks of holiness fell to this world, and there's Rapach, there's 288 sparks that have, which subdivided into many other millions of sparks, that got trapped in the Gashmistika world. They got trapped in Klipas Noiga. That's where they got trapped. And our job is to mevare them, is to refine them. Mevara means to select, to sift, to filter out those sparks and to elevate them to a Kedusha. And the Rebbe would always say about our generation that we are finished, or we almost finished that whole process of selecting all the sparks. We've got almost to the end of recapturing all these sparks. That's how you do it. So you have the famous Baal Shem Tov, for example. The Baal Shem Tov said, This is what he says. The Baal Shem Tov says like this: "Re'evim gam tzmeim." There's a pasuk in Tehillim that says, it describes the four things you have to thank Hashem for. One of them is a person who gets lost in the desert, he doesn't have food and hungry, and he comes out of the desert, he's got a bench goimel or bring a korban toida. But the pasuk there is describing the person that's hungry. And the pasuk says, "Re'evim gam tzmeim." They are hungry and also thirsty. "Nafshom bohem tis'atof." Their soul is clothed in their hunger. In other words, they're fully hungry. That's a simple shot, I think, right? So the Baal Shem Tov like this: "Re'evim gam tzmeim." When a person is hungry, it's actually the neshama is in the hunger. He explained, it's not a scientific explanation, but it's a spiritual explanation. If you suddenly have a very, very big hunger to eat an apple, right? What's actually happening is the following, says the Baal Shem Tov. That there's a spark in that apple that needs to be elevated. And your neshama senses that. And your neshama triggers a physical hunger. Right? Why are you laughing? It's an amazing explanation, right? And that's why you become physically hungry. Now the problem, why? Because the neshama itself can't do that. Only a physical person can do that. A person with the nefesh habamis can do that. It's up to the person, the physical person, to elevate the spark, right? To eat it properly, to make a bracha with kavanah, to eat it for the right reason, not to eat too much, and so on and so forth, and to hopefully eat it for the sake of Hashem, right? I mean, the lesson for us, by the way, is that when we do these things, at least we can try to be focused, we can try to be mindful of why we're eating, we can try get the mindset of eating for the sake of being healthy to serve Hashem, right? But anyway, if a person does it properly, so he's elevating the spark. The problem is, it's the neshama that triggered the hunger because the neshama is attracted to that spark. But when the person is triggered with a physical hunger, it's now up to the person to choose how he's going to execute that hunger. He's going to eat it like a grubber jung, as they say in Yiddish, or he's going to do it for the right reason. That's not up to the neshama anymore. That's up to the physical person, right? Okay, that's what it works. Okay, that's a moshel of food. Then he gives an example. He says like this, v'chein. Gives another moshel of something which can be potentially dangerous spiritually, but also can be used for kedusha because it actually is klipas nogen. V'chein o'omer milsa de b'dichasa. Let's say a person, I missed that line. If someone eats for Shabbos, 1 second. Yeah, for Shabbos, and it says it's the same thing. He says, "Azayn is barer chayes habasser v'hayayin." Then the life force of the meat and the wine, which we eat on Shabbos, or your nishma b'klipas noiga, which really was inspired by klipas noiga, it's sifted out, it's filtered out. V'oila la Hashem, and it's elevated to Hashem ka oila o ka korban, like an oila and a korban, like a burnt offering and a korban to Hashem. It's like bringing a sacrifice to Hashem. Right? Sorry. Well, yeah, so you ask, is that permanent? It is. Once a person eats something and he used the force and his intention and the strength and the nourishment he derived from that experience, he actually used to serve Hashem, it's now elevated. It's now done. Yeah. Another one. Similarly, a person who says a joke, like something light, right? Why does he do it? He does it the fakir daitoi, to open up his brain. To make his heart glad, Hashem, to be more sort of happy when he's doing Torah and Avodah, serving Hashem, shetrichim liyos besimcha, where you have to be besimcha. Also, it also elevates it. Now, he brings an example again. Like Rava did. Rava was one of the great Amoraim of the Gemara. The Talmidim, he did it when he taught his students. Sh'amar lifneyem, he said before them, milsed de b'dichase t'chila. He started a shiur with a bit of a joke. And they laughed. When they laughed, they became much more open to understand deep things, and was able to give the shiur. And when they gave the shiur, it became very serious. That's what the Gemara says, right? So here, the same thing, right? Here, the it's the same concept. A joke is a dangerous area. You know, it's interesting. It says in Chassidus that there's nothing greater than simcha, right? Being happy. But we also know that simcha can be very bad. It depends what you do with it. It says when a person is when a person is in a mindset of simcha, very, very happy, there is the danger of it becoming very much down the path of klipa, because then a person becomes very open and you loosen up and there's less boundaries and you become frivolous, right? It's called, in Kabbalah, in Chassidus, it's called plishtim. Plishtim were the Philistines who fought the Jewish people. It's called plishtim. Why? Because the plishtim, it's the klipa of plishtim. Because plishtim in Gemara, the word plishtim means open. In like Gemara Shabbos, when it talks about an Eruv, right? It talks about an alleyway or a street that's open on both sides. It hasn't got a date. So it's called Moveh HaMefulish. It's an open lane. Same thing. Openness is dangerous. And therefore, sometimes that simcha can be dangerous. That's why we always have in Torah, we talk about simcha. Even on simcha's Torah, it's got to be focused joy. It's got to be joy that's focused on serving Hashem, right? Even when it's extreme simcha. There's no place for wildness and just open looseness for no reason, right? But that's okay. So if you're very serious and we call like depressed most of the time, so you won't have that problem. But that's not what we're supposed to be. It says, if it's a Shabbos simcha, right? if you serve Hashem with joy. So joy can, when you say joy, sometimes means like you say a joke, and sometimes there's a concept of even in many communities, they have this minhag even by a chasana, because you want to make it joyous. So they have like a batchan, have a bit of a comedian. Obviously, it's clean and it's using jokes of Kedusha and things like that. But it can lead to, so that's the thing. But it can be Kedusha. So Rava was a great tzaddik, and he taka made a joke at the beginning of his shir, and everyone laughed. But it was pure Kedusha. In other words, he took the concept that, so a joke is klipas noiga, that's what it is, because it can go either way. But he took the chayis of that experience and elevated to Kedusha. Right? Just an interesting story. This is a book that has some stories connected to Tanya. Where is it? 1 second. Oh yeah. And as a Robin Barpog, he tells a story like this. He says that he used to go to a shir of a certain Rav. There was a shir in Chassid or something, and there was a Rav there. And he used to come to the shul to learn Tanya, I think with Rabbi Yoel Khan, the famous Chassid. But he never wanted to go to the Rebbe. He was like scared. He wasn't a Chassid, he wanted to go there. Okay. One time I told him that he has to go to the Rebbe. He should go to the Rebbe. He should come to Shabbos to Crown Heights, and he should sit by a Fabring. So he came, and he came in the middle of the Fabringen, and he kind of squeezed in to be able to hear what the Rebbe was saying. And suddenly, the Rebbe stopped what he was saying, and the Rebbe said something like a joke, right? And like a light thing, which the Rebbe would do from time to time. But like it was very, those who were a lot of Fabringen, the Rebbe was very obvious when the Rebbe did that, it was always like very measured. It was always like, it's there for a reason. Not always understood the reason, but it was there for you. So he was unimpressed. He came to that. That's what he came to Crown Heights for. He had a joke and whatever. Like, he thought he was coming. And he didn't tell anyone. He didn't say anything. 20 years went. And one time, there was a whole gathering in Bar Park where people who had become frum, had become more sort of close to Yiddishkeit, were there. There was a particular woman there. And she told the following story. She says like this. And this Rav was there when he was telling the story. He says, I was born in Brooklyn, but I was very disconnected from Yiddishkeit. In fact, I was so disengaged. The fact that I was born Jewish meant very little to me. One time, he says, however, because she explained. One time, she lived in Crown Heights. She like wandered over to a Fabringen, and she gave the thing. And she was standing there in the women's section. She was trying to listen, and like she's thinking to herself, like, why am I even here? Like, I don't know what brought me. I don't know why I'm here. Like, suddenly she says, the Rebbe told a joke, and everyone burst out laughing. She doesn't know why, but at that time, she just felt like a real warmth and a real connection, and started her journey to becoming fruit. And this Rav was sitting there, and he said, when did it happen? And it was exactly that same Shabbos, when he came, and he heard the joke, and he was impressed with the joke. He said, I knew what the joke was saying. So that's what I got. So just to finish off, there's a concept so there's two ideas in halacha. So there's one saying in Gemara, one has to understand what the saying means, but it symbolizes a certain concept. Because we talked before about eating meat, all those eating things which are more enjoyable than the regular food, right? So it says, Ama'aretz asul lechol basar. It says, an ignoramus is not allowed to eat meat. Now, it's not a halachic thing, because there's no way it says you have to be a Talmud Chacham to eat meat. But it's bringing out a point. In other words, if someone is an Ama'aretz, you're ignorant, you're empty, so you don't know why you're eating it, then it's dangerous. You have to learn why, and you have to learn what the purpose is, then you can do it. Similar thing, it says in the morning, you're not supposed to eat before davening. Just generally not supposed to eat before davening, right? Unless, I'll give you an exception in a second, unless you're eating to daven better, right? But generally speaking, not even that. Why? Because when we eat during the day, there's this process of birur, of sifting it out and elevating it. When we wake up in the morning, we're very physical, because our Hashem has been wandering around somewhere upstairs for the rest of the night, right? It takes time for Hashem to integrate. That's why we have to daven in the morning. When we daven, then we become more spiritual, then we qualify then to eat the food and to elevate it, right? Unless we know that there was a tradition by Chassidim that if you learn before davening and you're davening a bit late, and because of that you're hungry and therefore it's going to be hard to daven, then you're allowed to eat a little bit again, not to indulge, but to eat something before davening just so it takes away the hunger so you can daven better. So again, the same idea, you're eating for the purpose to be able to daven better. which is a story of Rebbetzin Rivka. Rebbetzin Rivka was the wife of the Rebbe Marash, the fourth Rebbe. She was a very great woman. She lived much longer than her husband. And the previous Rebbe used to spend a lot of time with her. It was his grandmother. And he used to hear a lot of stories from her, and he wrote them down and so on. So she was a daughter-in-law of the Tzemach Tzedek. When she got married, her father-in-law was the Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, famous Tzemach Tzedek. And she was a very devout woman. And she got sick once. And the doctors told her she has to eat early in the morning. But she was very frum, so she didn't want to eat before davening. So she used to get up and she used to eat, she used to daven quickly, so that she could eat afterwards, according to the instructions of the doctor, to eat early in the morning. So Tzemach Tzedek heard about it, so he called her in. And he said to her, it's not the way to do it. And he told her a famous line. He said, it's better for you to eat in order to daven than to daven in order to eat. Right? He said in Yiddish, best essence of the daven than the daven to the best. He said, eat properly, but because he knew that her eating would be a different kind of eating. It wasn't an indulgence eating, it was eating in order to daven properly, so it's not a problem. Same sort of concept. My Zayda told me that there was a Rav in where he came from, Dokshitz, it was a very, very famous chassid, Reb Leib Shainen, who would daven every day for hours. It was like my grandfather always used to describe, I used to daven, you can go in late morning in the shul, see him sitting in a corner crying, davening, very, very chassid. Daven every day for a few hours. And then also, he happened this thing, that the doctor told him it's not early, he has to eat in the morning. He's 2 weeks, he's getting older. And he didn't want to, because, you know, he's supposed to, even the chassidim ate before davening, but the bawash, to eat bread, for sure not, right? So until he was told by the previous Rebbe, said, you have to eat before davening. And the previous Rebbe said, my grandfather always used to tell the story, the previous Rebbe told him he has to eat pas shachris. Pas shachris is a term in the Gemara for breakfast. It means the bread of the morning. And the Friedrich Rebbe told him, and what does Pas Shachris mean? Translation, Schwarze Brot mit Butter, which means black bread with butter on it. You have to eat properly. So he had to get up and wash and eat a proper meal before davening so he could daven without, you know, but that's different. A different kind of eating. So this is what he explains. What he didn't explain is what happens if you don't do it for the sake of Hashem. In other words, it's upgraded if you do it for the sake of Hashem. What happens if you don't do it for the sake of Hashem? So that we'll learn next week.